Welcome to Shangri-La.
That's a scene from the 1937 movie Lost Horizon, which is based on the novel by James Hilton. It's the moment when Robert Conway first lays eyes on Shangri-La, the lost paradise, nestled in the Himalayas. It's one of those great Hollywood scenes, fantasy brought to the big screen. But is Shangri-La just a fantasy? The story actually goes back to ancient Buddhist texts, which suggest there really was such a place. Documentary filmmaker Michael Wood wanted to find the real Shangri-La, so he and his camera crew went trekking through the mountains to places barely touched by civilization. Wood says he was inspired by James Hilton's novel.
He was a canny writer, and he felt the mood of the times in 1933. You know, the Nazis had just come to power. As one writer said, there was the smell of burning in the air. And it was also a time when Tibet was viewed as the kind of last civilization that was kind of untouched in the world, you know, a forbidden land. And I think there's no question he had that in mind, but he also had in mind a much more ancient Tibetan and Indian legend, which goes back more than 1,000 years, that there was a world beyond the Himalayas, a kind of Buddhist world of peace, untouched by history, progress, and war, and destruction. And that myth became central to Tibetan Buddhism, and it still is today.
The interesting thing to me about this paradise, and I think to you from watching your film, is that it goes beyond being a place of peace. It is somehow a place of storage of all the best that's in the world, so that when we have made a mess of the world outside, there will be a source from which peace can be restored.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in the novel, just before the hero Conway leaves the secret valley of Shangri-La, the Lama says to him, "We have a dream and a vision in Shangri-La that the most beautiful things in the world are destroyed by war and lust and brutality, and they're crushed. And Shangri-La is here to preserve the wisdom that humanity will need," as he says, "when their violent passions are spent." And it's really interesting that Hilton wrote that in 1933, but when you look at the ancient Tibetan myths, in them is this idea of, in fact, a series of secret valleys that the Tibetans call Beyuls, 21 of these that are kind of hidden and will be activated in times of crisis and trouble. And in those valleys are buried or hidden or preserved the texts and treasures and wisdom of humanity that will be brought out when we need them. And when we did our journey through that part of Tibet, on foot through the Tibetan-speaking valleys on the very edge of Nepal that were untouched by the Chinese invasion, to our amazement, we stepped into Tibetan monasteries founded more than 1,000 years ago, where the treasures and manuscripts from the monasteries that had been destroyed by the Chinese had been gathered to be preserved. And the lamas of these monasteries were very conscious of, you know, the old legends. In fact, I remember saying to one engaging old lama in his great kind of red silk jacket, a big burly man, you know, as we sat drinking yak butter tea, and I told him the story of Shangri-La, and he just grinned and said, "Oh, it still exists."
The suggestion is that mankind has forever had this sense that we're not doing it right, but out there somewhere is a group who know what we ought to be doing and can help us when we need them.
You know, having done this journey, which I must say I found very affecting, you know, going through those Tibetan lands, we live in an age of globalization and the speed of change is immense. And because of that, it's not surprising that we're drawn to this idea that, you know, somewhere the ravages of time and history have been held back, and human beings, there's one place where human beings still live in harmony. Of course, when you talk to the Tibetan lamas about it today, they have a slightly different take on it, you know, because they see all of us Westerners as being obsessed with kind of material things and so on. And they say that every human being on earth can live in Shangri-La if we could only conquer that restless need that drives us, that makes us dream of paradises in worlds other than our own.
Did you get a sense of the spiritual nature of this? You must have become immersed in Buddhist culture. Did it give you a different sense of what Shangri-La might be, or Shambhala, as it was once called?
Well, I think, to me, from a lifetime of traveling, religions are produced by cultures, and they take on the form of their cultures. You know, Islam in Iran is a completely different matter from Islam in Arabia. And when you journey 2,000 miles to the south from where we were standing that wonderful afternoon to the tropical south of India, the religion is fecund and colourful, and it's scented with jasmine and incense and ghee and coconut and perfumes, and the people wear hardly any clothes in the summer because of the dripping heat, and the gods are fantastical and many-armed and multicoloured, and there are so many of them you can never even count them. When you go up into the wilds of the Tibetan plateau, the religion is that austere, shamanic kind. And the ideas of Tibetan Buddhism are very different from the religions of the plains of India. So yes, inevitably you kind of go out there and you understand the harshness of the landscape, the harshness of life, the central meditations of Tibetan Buddhism, of course, being on death.
I want to hear about your journey, because it was not an easy journey to take.
It wasn't an easy journey, and actually, you know, making films as we do, you have all sorts of logistical questions. For example, in this one, we had to journey through Western Nepal, which is now controlled by Maoist guerrillas. And we couldn't get filming permission to go there from the Nepali government because, of course, the guerrillas are trying to bring the government down. So we went effectively disguised as trekkers, you know, with our cameras in our tent barrels. And similarly, we didn't have permission to film in China, in Tibet. So again, we went as kind of well-heeled tourists going to the sacred mountain of Kailash, filmed on small cameras without filming permission. So even that was an edgy business. But the physical hardship was walking for a week along the edge of Nepal at high altitude, you know, up to about 15,000 feet, you know, which is kind of okay if you're acclimatized. And then the long journey up via the sacred mountain of Kailash and then across to the lost city of Saparang. Even when you could stay in a hotel, they don't have any electricity or running water, and your bottles of water froze in your room at night.
There's a lovely picture in one of your moments in the film when you got to a hotel, and I watched as they piled blanket after blanket after blanket on the bed, and I realized just how cold it must have been.
Yeah, no, it was very cold. I mean, we were there in late November, in fact, you know, just before the snows come. So it's a dangerous, risky time to go, because if you're cut off by the snow, you really are in trouble there, you know. But what it means is you get that translucent, dazzling blue sky without a cloud to be seen. And it's freezing, but it's wonderful. You look upon this amazing, mythic landscape, you know, and hard to think of it as a paradise, perhaps. It's cold and frigid and austere, and you don't see a tree. And many hours traveling, sometimes you don't see a human being. But it is a kind of paradise.
In these photographs that you took, the movies that you took in this part of the world, I can't feel the cold, but I can look and see the austerity you talk about, but also the suggestion that you can see forever in some of these landscapes, as though there is no end to the world. And you can understand how, as you say, a myth can begin there, where it feels like the world goes on.
It really
knowledge.
Does. I had one of those moments when you travel on a journey like this, of a real moment of revelation, where we'd gone through, you know, this long journey through Kathmandu and out to the west of Nepal, and then on foot for a week at high altitude, sleeping out, and then into Tibet. And the last day was 400 miles on dirt tracks to finally get to the verge of the lost city. And in the middle of the afternoon, we came out on a ridge about 5,000 meters, looking onto the back of the Indian Himalayas. And the vista, we reckoned, could have been anything between 500 and 600 kilometers from east to west. The most extraordinary thing about it was there was the Himalayas, you know, the eternal snows. And almost it felt as if we were looking down on them from the Tibetan plateau. We were almost at their level, as it were. And there you could see the highest mountain in India, Nanda Devi, and the sacred peaks around the sources of the Ganges and the Jamuna. And I had this terrible intuition that what appears to be the eternal snows when you're standing on the other side, looking up at this incredible vista, from here seemed to be a very, very narrow strip of ice and snow and a very, very fragile environment. And in the era of global warming, I think it is, you know. So that was one feeling. I mean, the other feeling was not a human being in sight, you know. It looked as if we could have just walked over those plateaus, over the glaciers and into India, and just 150 miles away, the plains of India, and, you know, more than a billion people going about their business, the most teeming place on earth, you know. And it really was a kind of transcendental moment, I think, where, funnily enough, the myth suddenly really took on its meaning for me.
Michael Wood is host of the PBS documentary Shangri-La and the author of the companion book In Search of Myths and Heroes.